Hey everyone, it's Allison. Today on The Body's Feed, I'd like to play you an episode of a new podcast. It's called Appearances, and it's by Sharon Mashihi. Appearances is a work of fiction, but it's closely based on Sharon's own life. You may recognize Sharon's name as longtime story editor of Bodies. Sharon is a brilliant storyteller, and she's a big part of why Bodies feels so intimate and powerful. And so, on a personal note, I'm really excited to share her new show with you. You're about to listen to episode 4, and here's what you need to know about what's happened so far. The main character, Melanie, wants a baby. She's a first-generation Iranian-American from a small Persian Jewish community, and in the eyes of her community and family, she's a total weirdo. In the first couple episodes, we meet Melanie's on-and-off-again boyfriend, Ponch. They're considering parenthood. Okay, here's the episode. Enjoy.
I want to talk again about my peeping Tom, the man I used to imagine was watching me through the window all throughout my childhood. Why did I cling so hard to the idea of him? On the one hand, we could say I was a lonely kid and the peeping Tom was essentially just an imaginary friend. Some kids have Snoopy. I had Tom. But then I was only 8 years old, and I chose as my imaginary friend the anonymous male gaze. Long before puberty, I already needed to believe a man was watching my every move in order to feel legitimate. I wish I could be more compassionate to my 8-year-old self. I really do. But I find myself mad at her for having such a low sense of self-worth, for setting us up for my current predicament, where I am a straight woman who dates men while simultaneously resenting them. Resenting them for having more power in the world. Resenting them for having power over me.
I want a blue-eyed, gap-toothed.
There's not going to be any blue eyes. You need both gene lines need blue eyes. There's going to be no blue eyes, okay? Move on.
Is that right?
Yes. It's impossible.
I am, of course, back together with Ponch. Back together with the commitment to stay together long term. And we're trying to get pregnant.
Wait a second. You know all this for sure?
Yes. Didn't you take fifth grade biology? You can't. Blue eyes is a recessive gene.
I was selling weed to my I was selling psilocybin mushrooms to my teachers in fifth grade, and you should know that.
Actually, I should say that Ponch and I are trying to get pregnant. My body has been shutting down. I try to force myself to have sex with him, but there is a clamping in my vagina, a kind of real-life version of the dentata myth.
It just like closes. It will not allow any piece of him anywhere in it.
And he couldn't handle that when you were like, I'm dentata. How did he react? Like, did he?
It's hard to explain. It's just like suddenly as if he's like a zombie. His self just leaves his body and he just turns so cold.
Ponch, can you please talk to me? Please. When Ponch was 5 years old, his father left the family, like fully abandoning Ponch and his siblings to be raised alone by their mother. But as his father was walking out the door for the last time, he promised Ponch he would write him letters. He promised him he would write every day. So every day for a year, little 5-year-old Ponch walked the long, lonely walk to the end of his driveway to the mailbox to see if his father had sent a letter. But his father never did send a letter. And so when I tell Ponch I can't have sex with him, when I turn dentata, he turns into the 5-year-old kid whose father went away and never wrote him a single letter. And when he turns into a 5-year-old, I turn into a 5-year-old too. The 5-year-old in a house where no one knows how to express love, and I can't get any of the kids to play with me at school. And so There we are, two overgrown five-year-olds in a bed, completely incapable of taking care of each other, let alone having sex.
Can you please talk to me?
I don't think I want to.
Can we, like, spoon or something?
No, not right now.
So we decide to see a couples therapist.
So you two have a seat. Anybody want any water?
The premise of going is heal the relationship, work through our sex stuff.
Sometimes I don't want to have sex. Sometimes I don't want to eat. Sometimes I don't want to sleep. Sometimes I don't want to drive. But you don't use it like, I feel like it, or no, I don't feel like it. You use it as a tool. It is a chip. It is a bargaining thing. And it is, I don't know what, a psychological tick or a mechanism or a template.
Yeah, but like for me, a big part of me feeling safe and okay in sex is knowing that the sex is not like a requirement. Knowing that no is okay, that it's okay if I don't want to. It's like as soon as I can know that saying no is okay, then I'm ready to have sex. But as long as I feel that it's not okay to say no, as long as I feel that like you're expecting it of me, that you won't be accepting of where I'm really at, then I can't have sex.
The therapist tells us that he observes that there's a lot of pressure and anxiety around our sex life.
Okay. I observe that there's a lot of pressure and anxiety around your sex life.
And he asks us why.
And I want to ask you, why?
Well, isn't it obvious? I'm dying to have children, and I'm afraid of doing it with the wrong person, and I'm afraid of running out of time.
That's when Ponch says,
Mel, I am not the wrong person. I would like to have a baseball team's worth of kids with you. I want to have a basketball team's worth of kids with you. And I don't even know anything about sports. I just want a team. Let's do this. We can do this.
And I don't know what it is, but something about the sports analogy just really does it for me. And I become very aroused. And we go straight home after therapy, and we have a whole bunch of sex. And do not use a condom.
If you had a dick, you could fuck me like this.
Tuesdays after therapy become our honeymoon period. We are making love like we haven't made love in years.
You can grab your ass cheeks.
And then it happens. I miss my period. It's been a weird day, to say the least. I've been postponing doing the test because I'm afraid of finding out the results either way. Both ones scare me. And if my period is late, but I'm not pregnant, what the fuck is wrong with my reproductive system? It's fun to sit on the toilet for a while after you pee, because then you
takes all these extra drips that come out of you, which usually, like, I don't let those drips drip, do I? I just get right up and go. But not today, buddy. Today, I sit on the toilet for 3 minutes. There's a minute and a half to go. And it's kind of a shocking number of extra drips that are dripping out of me. This is probably why I always feel like I have to pee, because there's always pee left. I don't let myself finish pee. Why? Why am I in such a hurry? What is so important that I can't just finish peeing? Drops are still coming. I think that was the last drop. So weird. In 30 seconds, I will know if I am pregnant. Weirdly. It's like every morning I wake up and in my journal I write the words, I am alone, or I feel alone, or so alone, or just alone, period. But in this moment, I do not feel alone. Okay. Not pregnant. Okay, cool.
Sometimes in life, you really, really want something to happen. But then when that thing doesn't happen, you are surprised to find that more than anything else, you are relieved. Because even though you really wanted that thing to happen, you weren't ready for it.
Punch, can we cuddle? Can we?
Sure enough, after my negative test result, all the days that we don't have therapy to turn us on, Punch and I are back to Dentata and 2 5-year-olds in a bed.
Seriously? You're gonna turn away from me again? I am the same person I was on Tuesday.
I start to ask myself, am I being foolish clinging to Punch? Is our relationship really my only path to motherhood? I start to do some simple math. Let's say Punch and I do decide to break up. What's that process gonna take? Like 6 months? At that point, I'll be 35 and a half. I'll need a few months to be single and get over him. That takes me to 35 and 3/4. Then I'll have to download Tinder, date around, and find someone new. So 6 months to a year, 36 and 3/4. Once I find someone, we should date each other a year before we think about having kids. 37 and 3/4. If I make an exit, I can be pregnant by 37 and 3/4. And I can be a mom by 38 and a half. That's not so bad, because I could see this rigmarole going on endlessly and never ending up in a child. I need to cut my losses and walk away for good. I work up the courage to tell the therapist that we have been using our sessions with him as an aphrodisiac, but that we aren't getting anywhere in mending our relationship. To which the therapist says,
"Oh, no, no. Okay. Let's make a rule that you don't see each other between sessions."
And that rule is helpful. That rule kills everything. And so, after 7, I kid you not, 7 false breakups, we end it. Like, really, really, really end it. I swear.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi.
I go to his apartment one last time
and gather all my belongings in a giant blue suitcase.
All right, do you want to take this box of your turmeric tea?
I make my way to the subway at Union Square and realize that he's followed me.
Mel! Hey, Mel! Melanie!
He asks me if it's bye for now or bye
is this
forever.
Bye for now or is this bye forever?
And then he kisses me on the subway platform and says we're being like Harry Met Sally. And I say that we aren't like Harry Met Sally because they ended up together and we are saying goodbye.
Do you want to come back to the apartment one last time?
Then he asks me if I want to go back to his apartment one last time. And I'm like, are you kidding me?
It'll give us something to hold on to.
Are you kidding me? And then I literally have to claw my way out of his grip and onto the train. And then that's it.
I don't think that you should feel... I mean, it's just like any time a woman feels bad about anything to do with being a woman, I think it's worth analyzing.
I call my best friend Caitlin and tell her that I'm ashamed to be single.
Yeah, I mean, that just seems like another layer of misogyny. Do you know what I mean?
It's not the singleness exactly that I'm ashamed of, but the fact that I'm single and desperate for a baby. You know, like there's a certain kind of woman who, like, let's say you go to this woman and you're like, how are you doing, woman? And she's like, well, I'm fine considering, except for the fact that my biological clock is tick, tick, ticking.
Yeah.
Like, I never wanted to be that kind of woman. Yeah. My shame exists as a voice in my head that I like to call the voice of repressive and unsophisticated feminist cruelty. This voice says, aren't feminists supposed to be above traditional feminine desires, above needing a man, and above needing a baby?
The stereotype of the woman who's like husband hunting, you know, and how toxic that stereotype is. Do you know what I mean?
Like, yes, like, that's, you've named it. That is what I'm humiliated about. I'm humiliated that I am now about to be husband hunting. I think that it's kind of ageist also. And I never expected that I would be facing ageism in a real and major way as a 35-year-old. But the ageism that I feel is that, like, because I want a partner now and I feel like finding a partner is time sensitive, I'm a husband hunter.
But do you think that there's some way that we can break that stereotype down, you know? Like there's just decades of bad sitcoms, bad rom-coms, bad culture that depicts women in that way. And I wonder if the truth of the husband hunter is actually much more dignified.
Well, it makes me think about how women, particularly straight women, were supposed to be submissive. So when I'm in my 20s, I have the luxury of just like walking around the world in a cute dress and hot men asking me what my name is. And that's how it's supposed to happen for a woman. I'm supposed to get plucked out of my life by a man, be chosen by him, and be taken in by his like masculine arms. And when I become the pursuer, because I need something from a man, when I no longer have the luxury of waiting around to get plucked, suddenly I'm desperate. Whereas the man who wants a woman is hunting for a woman is having prowess and he's a tiger. I become a desperate loser because I'm now hunting for a man. And that's very like, that's a dominant thing for me to do. That's a powerful thing for me to do. And of course I feel completely unsexy and I feel like I lose points for being in this position. In my head, it's not just the voice of feminist cruelty that's talking to me. There's also the voice of my countless straight male friends who confide in me about their dating lives. These voices say, it's so taxing to date women in their mid to late 30s. They only have one thing on their mind, baby, 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 baby. And that just feels like a lot of unattractive pressure.
And I'm just kind of like...
My friend, Ari.
Oh, they're turned off. I'm like, just because I think I haven't dated a dude in a long time, so... But I'm like, they don't think that's hot.
Well, if you went on a first date with somebody and they told you that they wanted a baby, would you think that was hot? Or would you feel like this is too much for the first date?
I feel like plenty of people go into dating someone being like, I know I want someone that is compassionate. I know I want somebody that will want to cook with me. I know I want somebody who wants to go hiking with me. Why is it like so fucking shitty to be like, I want somebody who wants to have a baby with me? Why do we have to think that?
Yeah.
It's true. You're so right. Like, going into a first date would be a totally fucking taboo thing. Or it would make maybe a dude or whoever feel like, oh, she just wants me for that. But like, don't we want companionship for all kinds of things, and that's okay to want it for that?
I think, yeah, I mean, I wish I weren't like this, but I'm like, sorry, kind of constitutionally, I'm sorry, you know?
Like you're wrong? What do you mean?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I always want to apologize for myself. That's just kind of like my habitual way. And yeah, oh, that kind of makes me cry, but it is.
For having desires?
Yeah.
That are yours? You don't need to be sorry for that. There's so many, like, peoples inside of us, like, telling us what's right and fucking wrong, and it's not even like our own making. Like, if you could go on a date and be like, do you want a baby? Because I do. Like, would you?
Yeah, I mean, if I had the courage, that's just what I mean by sorry. I'm constantly like fighting myself back because I have just a fear of being wrong, and I'm unfortunately guided through my life by seeking the approval of the other. And that makes me sad for myself, but it also just makes me sad for, like, the person I could be to the world. You know those self-improvement runs you go on after you have a breakup, where you start to believe that you are the only person in the world who has ever considered the possibility of having a healthy lifestyle, where with every step that pounds on the pavement, you are taking yourself one step further away from your awful, miserable past and one step closer to your incredible, entirely different, more advanced, healthier, more successful, fully integrated, like, incredible future. Go on Tinder. Find my love. Have our baby. It comes out of my womb, down the birth canal, out my vagina. I got a match. His name is Andrew. Andrew. Can I date someone whose name is Andrew? So Andrew is 38 years old, white guy. He's a calligrapher. Like, his whole job in the world is writing wedding invitations. I find that to be a very gentle job. I like it. His profile says he's 5'5", my exact height, a petite man who makes gentle art. Maybe he is my destiny.
Hey.
But when I meet him in person, I have that devastating moment that we all hate when we online date.
You too. It's really nice.
Where it feels like his real life self is nothing like his pictures. It isn't exactly that he doesn't look like his pictures. I mean, he kind of looks like his pictures, but he animates his body so differently than, I guess, what his pictures led me to believe.
No. Yeah, it's always a little awkward, like, you know. Anyway, the first moments, right?
But we sit down at this outdoor cafe, and he tells me about his life.
My mom and I moved in with my grandmother, so I was kind of raised by my grandmother and my mom for the first half of my life.
And I tell him about my life.
Nobody liked me in middle school, but then when I got to high school, I guess I kind of just, like, blossomed and things started to change, but my parents were really...
And soon, it doesn't matter. I think to myself, oh.
It was in high school that I picked up calligraphy. Well, not calligraphy specifically.
Maybe I can be in love with this person.
art.
Maybe this person can be the father of my child.
I started getting really into that, so then I applied to different art and design programs and got into...
Within 2 weeks of meeting him, I give Andrew the keys to my apartment. Within a month, we are sleeping beside each other, 7 nights a week.
Do you want to go to bed?
Do you want to go to bed? I mean, whatever you want.
It might seem fast, but Andrew checks all the boxes. He's progressive. He's financially stable. He's a good cook. His number one priority is making sure I feel good and that I'm comfortable and that I'm happy.
All I want to do is give you pleasure. It makes me happy to give you pleasure. Is there something wrong with that?
One morning, while we're fucking, I accidentally blurted out,
I want you to give me babies, 1,000 babies. I want you to shoot your sperm right into me and make me so fucking pregnant, please.
His jaw drops and he looks absolutely stricken.
Wait, what?
I'm sorry I said that.
I mean, are you serious?
Well, I mean, maybe not right this second, but yeah. Yeah, I want you to make me pregnant.
Are you serious? Like, I'm so into that. Is that weird?
You did?
Yeah, we already, like, said that we love each other, and we even said that secretly we whispered it that we wanted to marry each other and have babies together.
Damn. Wow.
And he's just, like, a normal, like, man. Like, as in he's not a weirdo. He's, like, a regular man with a job who, like, is gonna be a husband and a dad someday and probably
me. Whoa. It's fast, no? Remember, you didn't even really like the way his face moved. That's what you said.
Now I love the way his face moves. I love the way his face moves now.
Okay, good.
After just a couple months of dating, I introduce Andrew to my family. When he meets my family, everyone talks over him, and he barely knows how to interact with them. And I find myself offended by this. Offended that my family seems so foreign to him, and he seems so foreign to them. And then a word enters my mind. A word my parents have often used to describe white American men. Weak. And this word gives me pause. This word makes me realize something fundamental. Andrew is not my type.
I mean, my mom always said that marriage is usually... like, you look to your left at the time when you want to get married, and whoever's there, you just marry them, which is not a very romantic sentiment. But I guess she's saying it's just, it is a timing thing.
But the weird thing is, like, I had a person to my left, and that person was Ponch, and I shoved him out of my left. You know, like, I had a person to my left, I knew it was time to get married, and then I shoved that person the fuck out of my life.
Right. And then you found someone who's pretty much the opposite.
And I found someone who's pretty much the opposite. And he's currently the person standing to my left.
My views on Andrew are that he is totally devoted to you. You know, like, he worships you.
But doesn't that make you think he's a total loser? Like, he barely knows me. Why is he worshiping me so hard? There must be something wrong with him.
It makes perfect sense to me. Like, you're so fucking beautiful. You're really cool. Why judge that? Like, he's excited about you. That makes sense.
Like, he just seems like a really kind of like a solid, sweet, loving, doting man with... Andrew, you're in a situation where you're the dom. You set the tone. It's on your terms, you know? Like, he's completely deferring to you. He's submissive to you on almost every front. And I wonder, like, what's that about? Like, I guess this is your chance to set the tone.
I get it. It's embarrassing enough to be... a woman who's attracted to men, and then add on top of that
that I'm a woman who's only attracted to men who dominate over me. I'm only attracted to men who have like the slightest streak of misogyny in them. I'm only attracted to men who are arrogant. I'm only attracted to men who are sexually aggressive with me. I get that. Like, that's fucked up. And it goes against my ideals and my idea of myself. But like, there's my ideals and there's the truth of what I want and there's the truth of who I am. And I'd rather live my life according to the truth of who I am than, you know, than the other way around.
Right.
When it comes to dating men, I find myself in a catch-22. I find it humiliating to date men. I find it humiliating to sit in front of a man and to wait for him to evaluate me. Am I sufficiently feminine for him? Am I sufficiently young-looking, attractive, malleable? And I don't like the way I become around men. So deferential, so eager for them to approve of me, so willing to shed the self I really am for the self I think they want me to be. And yet, that's only how it is around a certain kind of man, a more alpha, traditionally masculine man. Certain men don't make me feel that way at all. Certain men leave me comfortable to be as masculine as I want to be, as dominant as I really am, as complicated and as messy. But the hitch is this. I am not attracted to that second kind of man. Try as I might, I'm just not into it. My pride prohibits me from continuing to date the first kind of man, and my honest-to-God preferences prohibit me from dating the other kind. And I'm ashamed of this because by not being attracted to that second kind of man, I am perpetrating the same offense committed by men who are not attracted to me because I'm too dominant and too masculine. And yet, as I speak these words aloud, I know I am being reductive. The world, I know, is not made up of just two kinds of men. I need to be willing to see men with the same complexity that I want them to see me, but then it's going to take a lot of growth on my part to be able to see men with that complexity. And growth takes time, and I have a biological clock. I realize something. Stark as day. I mean, what does it really take to have a baby? A sperm and an egg and a financial situation that allows you to care for that baby. Do I actually need a man for all of that? The egg I have, the money I can come up with, and the sperm? Well, there are other ways to get sperm.
What's up?
I have some news.
Some news. Okay.
I decided that I'm going to be one of those women who, like, goes to a sperm bank and is a single mom for the rest of her life. I'm going to have a kid on my own, by myself.
Oh. Whoa.
Do you think it's a bad idea?
Just let me have a moment. I just need a moment. Don't interpret my reaction, please. I'm just, that's a huge fucking deal. That's major.
I want a baby. I don't have the right man. I'm sick of desperately, frantically trying to make it work with men. I want to have a baby alone.
Wow. Whoa. It's a big deal. I don't know. It's like a lot. It's a lot to do it by yourself. Like, that's, wow. I guess, like, politically, I can see the value of a choice like this, you know? Like, I think it's really fucking cool and, like, you know, important. But can we just take off the ideological hat for a second? I don't know. That's big. That's major. Like, to decide to do it on your own. Like, what are you thinking? What's happening? You know, like, what are you feeling like about that part of it?
Well, I did the math and I need $30,000.
No, but I mean like the child, the rearing of the child in as a solo person, as a human, as a one person.
Like part of me thinks it's going to be easier. Like I watched my mom, she quote unquote had a partner. But it just felt like actually my dad was just bringing more stress to the situation, you know. It was already hard enough for her to be raising her kids. And like here was this person who was constantly fighting with her. And that only made raising the kids harder. And it only made us, the kids, more fucked up. So why not eliminate that from the equation? Constantly trying to compromise with some man.
Right.
And just like devote myself to having a kid. I feel like I'm probably being naive, but I think that anyone who has a kid goes into it perhaps with a little bit of naivete. Like you sort of go like, yeah, I know everybody says it's hard, but like, I'm going to do it. You know, that's why the population continues, because everybody is willing to do this crazy thing that's extremely difficult because they kind of can't help themselves. And also like I do everything alone. I can't believe that it took me this long to realize I wish I had done this 10 years ago, you know?
Damn, that's a fucking power move. You know, that's amazing.
You just heard episode 4 of Appearances, a new podcast by Sharon Mashihi from Mermaid Palace and Radiotopia. You heard the voices of Thatcher Keats, Armin Bazarian, Phoebe Unter, Ari Mejia, and Georgia Wall. This piece was executive produced and edited by Caitlin Prest and associate produced by Ariel Mejia. You can subscribe to Appearances on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts.